Good afternoon and welcome to our podcast, All Things Finance in Small Businesses and Emerging Mid-Market Companies. My name is Kevin Uphill and I'm the chairman of Avondale Corporate. We're a corporate finance firm specialising in helping people buy and sell companies, but we also do employee ownership trusts and we do a lot of work around private equity and particularly private equity growth capital transactions, at fundraising to grow the business dramatically, but also potentially selling somebody equity in your business. Works very well for emerging mid-market businesses, and we're incredibly busy on that front. There's something like $3 billion available in London alone, looking to go to smaller companies in that private equity space. But I'm also joined today by Alistair Aird. He's from some good friends of ours, Funding Friends, and they help people on the commercial finance front, more from a property point of view or asset-based lending. They also do some cash flow loans, which we do as well. But we work closely with them when it's a more specific asset-based or commercial loan. And today, our objective is to try and demystify a little bit the post-COVID finance arena. Things have moved on a bit. They were pre-COVID, but I think obviously the post-COVID environment has changed the marketplace. So helping you hopefully understand more some of your options and where you can go. I'm feeling under pressure today. I've known Alistair a long time. I didn't know he actually had a finance MBA. So I'm hoping he's going to be a real guru on this subject.
Well, that's very kind of you, Kevin. It was an awfully long time ago. So as with all these things, I've probably forgotten more than I ever learnt, but thank you.
Well, but he's also run SME, so, you know, he hopefully, like you, he's got some practical experience of what it's like against the coalface running companies. Of course, today we may also bring in a little bit of, you know, there is some distress out there we ought to consider. What's happening there? So I've got some views on what's happening in the market, but I'm really just going to pick up on one for Alistair. And by the way, the podcast, 30, 40 minutes. If you like it, please forward it, please circulate it to your colleagues. Hopefully useful. We can't cover it all. It's too big an arena. So post-COVID, Alistair, you know, obviously the banks were heavily involved with CBIL and led that, and the main high street banks in particular. But the specialist lenders are back in town with a vengeance. And, you know, they were growing anyway, sort of pre-COVID. What's, you know, people like Shawbrooks, Fincats, Aldermere, what's your view on why they're doing so well and why they are succeeding where the big banks aren't? And what are you seeing there in terms of the way they're approaching it?
Okay, well, perhaps if I start just by putting a little bit of numerical context around what's happened over the last few years. If you're looking at sort of SME market space, in 2019, so pre-COVID, there was about £25 billion of gross lending to the SME market. That in 2020 leapt unprecedentedly to £63 billion, which gives you an idea of the scale of lending that came from the government to support businesses throughout COVID. In 2021, that's fallen back to more normalized levels in around about sort of £23 billion. So that massive peak in 2020 was a huge distortion on the marketplace. Typically, And over time, the percentages are shifting slightly away from the banks. But at the moment, it's around about half of all lending comes from the banks, and half of all lending comes from specialist providers that aren't on the high street. If I talk about banks, I'm talking about the main high street banks. But there is a, you know, that certainly wasn't the case 10, 15 years ago. It'd be much, much more related to the high street banks, and this growth in external providers, as we've talked about, the likes of Shawbrooks and Thincats, and, you know, we can talk, you know, a good number of them have really stepped in when they've seen a gap in the marketplace, as banks have become more and more cautious as to what they want to lend to. Nowadays, you know, banks will be the funder of choice because their rates are typically lower. But the reason their rates are lower is because they only lend to the least risky prospects. Now, there's plenty of opportunity in the marketplace for other providers who are able to flex their appetite, to flex their risk reward profile to support the SME businesses in the country.
And what we're seeing there, as I said, if you look at a cash flow loan, which typically a multiple of EBITDA, probably doesn't take you until you're doing more than say $500,000 plus profit. So not great for the small guy, but good for the more emerging mid market, as we call it. But on a term loan, cash flow loan, over 5-6 years, High Street Bank typically 3-4%, but the alternative lenders 6-7%, and that's the kind of rates we're seeing. Would you agree with that?
I would say that if you need to push the multiples up a little bit, if 2x EBITDA is not going to do it to get the deal over the table, there are guys that will look at sort of 3%, might even squeeze a little bit more if the cash flow is really strong and secure. But you could be paying up to 9-10% for that sort of money. And then on top of that, you've got one or two niche mezzanine providers who will put another turn, another typically 1x EBITDA on top, and they're looking for sort of 15-20%, and it then becomes much more blurred as to whether that's more equity return type territory.
In a past life, you've worked within corporate finance directly, Alistair, as I do, and of course we'll remember net present value of money and. So having the cash to do your acquisition or your organic growth is worth the percentage rate, so long as you deliver. And debt is still cheaper, even at 10s and 12% in equity, because you never know what the cost of buying that out is going to be. And you've sold part of your business. So that's kind of the fundamentals here, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. Now, I mean, you'll know as well as I do that there's a place for equity, and obviously, equity has advantages in as much as it is, it doesn't have to be repaid in the same way that a bank debt has to be repaid on a particular schedule. Everybody's in the same boat in an equity world. They get to share in the upside. One of the things I found interesting when I moved from M&A to banking was the nature of the risk averseness that they take. But when you start to view it from a banker's point of view, if you had, I'm dreadful at maths off the top of my head, but if you were lending £1 million and you were charging 4%, you're getting your £4,000 a year. If you have 10 of those, you're lending 10 million, you're getting £40,000 a year. It doesn't take, it can take one debt to wipe out everybody's returns. So hence they are very cautious in what where they lend. They do only lend where they are really very, very comfortable, because the margins, particularly at the lower end over base, are quite skinny, and it doesn't take many bad debts to really wipe out an awful lot of good work. So
but I think that summarizes the difference for me between the High Street and the alternative lenders, if you like, because you moved from M&A to banking, but I moved from banking to M&A. So I don't know who's right, Alistair, but I remember when I worked at NatWest, the bank manager went round and made the decision. And now that was in the late 80s, early 90s, sorry, showing my age. But you don't get a decision from the High Street Bank. It's all credit committee. And it still is with the alternative lenders, but they do have frontline managers that will take a punt more on the risk, won't they? But the converse is the interest is higher.
Exactly. But, better an expensive cake than no cake at all. There is absolutely that place for a wide array of funding providers. And what's happening outside the high street banks is that people are finding a niche that needs financing, really understanding that niche. And because they understand it well and in depth, they can afford to be or appear to be, you know, a little bit more risky because they know what they're talking about. They're only focusing on one area. They're specialists in that. They're not a jack of all trades. So, you know, they're much closer to the asset or the sector or whatever it may be that they are specializing in. And that gives them comfort to take the slightly higher risks that that they take.
I think that's in my experience, and would you say that's also particularly important in asset-based lending as well, isn't it? Because, or stock valuation lending, because, you know, they know what it's worth, whereas everybody else is just sort of looking at the balance sheet and going, well, that's what the numbers say, but, you know, what's the reality on you know, on resale or foreclosure? Because again, that's the risk factor for them, isn't it? You know, what's the debenture on security? How can you get your money back if things go wrong? What's left?
Exactly. So, you know, they spend a lot of time, you know, tracking the market. They'll know exactly what assets are selling for, whether they are distressed asset sales or fair market value asset sales, by being close to that. Nobody wants to take the asset. You know, that's probably worth saying. Nobody sets out to be the, you know, to have to recall an asset for sale to repay a debt. Nobody wants to do that. And everybody realizes if it's got to that stage, something's probably gone wrong earlier in the line. But given that they know where the market is for those assets, who the buyers are, and they'll have those relationships in place beforehand, it does give them comfort to lend against, you know, those sort of niche assets.
And it's interesting because, you know, they will take first security, the majority of lenders, right? The ranking is first, so they've got that fallback. Are you seeing any that are happy to flex that? And then what's happening also on personal guarantees? Because that's always been a thorny point in this sort of lending, you know, directors' personal guarantees. What trend are you seeing there?
Yeah, well, certainly when I was at a high street bank, the reputational risk of being seen to kick somebody out of their family house to pay off a PG was such that none of the big banks would ever really, I wouldn't say never, but, you know, it was the utter last resort. And I never saw it happen in my 8 years in that environment. Further down the food chain, where the companies have less reputation, there is, and they are taking a higher risk, and everybody is aware of that, that balance may change slightly. Having said that, a lot of what I'm seeing, I was talking to a company today that specializes in trade finance. So if you wanted to buy something abroad, didn't have the cash up front, they would lend you the cash for you to buy and import that good. You know, they charge, you know, a pretty high rate of interest, certainly when you work it out on an annual basis. But for that, they will not take, you know, they will take a second charge. You know, they will rank behind an existing debenture. They will take a PG. They will want to know that there is a property in the background, but they won't include the property within the PG. They just like to know that there is an asset there in the background to support the PG. And you'll get some companies, again, you'll pay for the privilege where PGs aren't required. Certainly on an asset finance deal, you know, it may well be that the percentage lent against the asset and the, you know, the security of that asset, the, you know, the knowledge as to exactly how much that asset is worth, could mean that they're happy with, you know, that level of security. People don't look for PGs, you know, just for the hell of it. Typically, if the asset is secure enough and the, you know, they've got comfort in that, then that will do.
So that's really interesting, Alison. You know, if you're a finance director or CEO, you're looking for growth. You know, there are loads of options. It's almost you know, such an art now, it's very difficult to know where to find. Now, obviously, we would say, you know, call us and we've got a clue, because, you know, you've got to have those contacts. You've got to know which one works, you know, when an ID facility works, an asset loan or cash flow, and be clear what type of lending best worked for that business model, really.
Yes, I think there's two aspects to that. The first one is I spend a lot of my time checking out what is in the marketplace, what is available, what products are available, who the funders are. There's always new ones coming into the market. We had an email from one of the small startup banks a week or so ago saying we're closed for business for the time being. You know, we've got enough on. I don't know what the story behind that is, whether that is just the spin or whether that's the reality of the situation. But all of a sudden, you know, they're closed for new business. What I would say with any financing is it's important to consider what you are financing and then find the right source of finance for that product. If you're one of the things about the C-bills, et cetera, they were term loans. They fixed a problem of immediate cash flow very quickly, and they are simple. This is how much you borrow. This is how much you pay it back over time. They're not designed to support growth. Over time, you know, your facility reduces. Whereas something like an invoice finance facility, your invoice finance facility is typically 75-85% of the value of your debtor book. Now, as your debtor book grows, because you are bringing on more customers, so your facility grows. And that is the sort of financing that will grow with you as you grow your business. What you wouldn't want to do, though, is necessarily use an invoice finance facility to buy a company, because you're back to more cash flow loans where you know exactly where you are. So you do need to marry the type of funding that you look for, or you ideally need to marry the type of funding that you look for with the purpose for which you're planning on.
And I think the important point you sort of picked on there, Arthur, years ago actually with NatWest, but before when I ran a mortgage desk, and oh my word, you had to track every scheme and every loan to value and every percentage because there's so many options, and that is a full-time job, which is where, you know, an organisation like yours comes in, because you've got the resources to do that. I think that's very, very important for people on choice. Can I just go back there? Something that's worrying me about the conversation, because we need to talk about it. It's the elephant in the room. 25 billion to 63 billion civil loans, right? Now, we are getting some distress cases coming across our desk, naturally with the furloughs finishing, but you've also got, yeah, business models have changed quite dramatically. Not COVID accelerated it, you know, the whole tech thing, the virtual working and so on. And people haven't necessarily adapted. So margins are being cut, costs have gone up, and profits have gone down. And of course, you're getting people going, well, I've got a civil loan, but now I've got a cash flow issue. What else do I need to do? And I think that's going to be a big challenge for us as organisations, actually, over the next 2 or 3 years, because borrowing money isn't always the answer. Changing your business model may be part of the answer to it, because, you know, you can keep borrowing money, but you can end up with what they call it, zombie companies, isn't it? So companies that can service debt, but they never pay it off. And that's no good to anybody.
It isn't, and I suspect there's more than a few out there at the moment, particularly in the benign interest rate markets that we've had over the last for quite a while now. They've been very benign, and the banks have been more than happy, just, you know, for companies that were struggling, say, well, look, just, you know, pay the interest, and we'll keep the lines open. From that point of view, it has been quite benign. One of the things that I think we're going to begin to see is companies that have taken out CIBIL loans, and we've got a situation, taken out a CBILS loan, as I say, typically with their high street banking provider, because the banks had government support to do that. This company that in my example now wants to move their banking, but this CBILS loan is sitting there being a fly in the ointment, because you can't, a new bank can't take over that CBILS loan and have the same government support for it. So it now becomes a bit of a trick to stick the customers to the to their existing bank, and anybody looking to take over that banking and support this business in its next phase is going to have to replace that CBILS loan with a commercial loan that that doesn't have that government support to it. So I think that's potentially something that that will come up, that I think potentially will cause some companies a little bit of pain as they realize that maybe they're going to have to sit it out with their existing provider, at least for the duration of that CBILS loan, if there aren't other banks that will be able to take that over on purely market terms.
And actually, the fundamentals therefore of lending as well still sit, if you can't, at the end of the day, it's what's the headroom in your cash flow to make the affordability to pay. So you can't expect to keep civil loans and then take loans out on top and necessarily service it. So you have got to restructure.
Exactly. And there's a reason why, the big accountants are beefing up their corporate restructuring side of life at the moment. Because, this is going to cause pressure, and particularly as interest rates start to rise, as I'm sure they will, that's just going to add to the pressure.
So if let's cover that. So if anybody's facing distress, insolvency practitioners are excellent, business recovery, excellent, restructuring, there are options. You can also do a CVA, creditors voluntary arrangement. We didn't bring an insolvency practitioner, but we could have done for the podcast, and maybe we'll do that another day. But I think, so if anyone is interested in that, do let me know. But I think those are an angle. For me, the other angle is you can remodel your, we had someone who had a Funding Circles loan. They hadn't realized they were a zombie company. They came to us and said, look, we've got this great brand, but we're just going around in circles. And we said, well, you're a zombie company. Your balance sheet's really, taken a knot. And we went through, and actually, just by being ruthless, we created a more sustainable business model, but saved them 150 grand a year. Which more than amply over the years will start sorting out, and it's a smaller company, but it can be done. But it's about being objective about your business model. We outsource the finance rather than having an internal finance person. There's all sorts of options available. So there's angles.
Yeah, but what it requires, as in your example, is the guys to admit it.
Yeah,
and to look for that help.
Yeah,
I think the ones that will struggle, because there are solutions out there, but the ones that will struggle will be the ones who think, oh, I can get through this, it's just about to turn the corner, whatever. Just get help.
I remember in the 08, 09, I mean, we've been very fortunate, we're very successful, but in 08, 09, in that crash, we thought COVID might have the same impact. It hasn't. We've done more private equity deals, for example. But 08, 09, we were in that situation ourselves. We had offices all over the place. I went into the bank and said, look, we want to borrow some money. I'm a high net worth individual. I've got some, property, and, I'm prepared to personally guarantee it. And they said, what are you doing? I said, M&A. And they knew. They knew it was on the down. So they said, no. Best thing that ever happened to us. Because it forced us to redo the business model. And the business model was wrong anyway when we stopped looking at it. We had offices all over the place. We didn't need it with Google. Sometimes these things can be an opportunity. But that's kind of the downside of civil. Let's look at the upside. Of that 63 million or billion, there are quite a few companies that have never touched it and didn't need it in the first place. They weren't to know that. Should they be using it to grow or do acquisitions, or should they just be looking at alternative sources of funding?
Well, if they've got it sitting there and the rates are relatively attractive for them, then and it's an appropriate use of money. If they would make those decisions on a commercial basis anyway, then I would say yes. If it's fortuitous, look, we've suddenly found we've got £500,000 that we didn't expect to have. Let's blow it on some ambitious expansion. Then I might be a little bit more wary as to recommending that. If it's the right thing for the business on a commercial level, then absolutely, you know, don't look the gift horse in the mouth. But at the same time, you know, I would be wary about suddenly looking at your bank balance, thinking you've got another £500,000 or whatever it is in there that, you know, that you weren't expecting, and then thinking, right, you know, I'd better spend it, because I would say that was wrong. If it's the right thing for the business to do commercially, then I would be in favour. But don't just spend it.
You reminded me of a joke, Alistair. There's a guy in a hot air balloon, okay, and he's floating along, and he comes down to the ground, sees this chap or lady on the ground, and says, excuse me, do you know where I am? And the chapel lady in the ground shouts up and says, yes, you're at 32 degrees longitude, 48 degrees latitude, and 28 foot off the ground. And the guy in the balloon shouts down and says, well, that's useless. That's really specific information. You must be an FD. And the guy on the ground shouts back up and says, well, you must be an MD. You've got your head in the clouds and no idea where you're going. But the point is, you need both, right? You've got Absolutely. To do the modelling. What's the return on investment? What's the strategy? How are you going to get it back? And actually, I think now's the time for a real opportunity there. The CEOs that get help, get the right modelling, get the right finance, look at that ROI. But also, how can you put your business model ahead of what changes you see in the market, where you can create pull, not push, i.e., getting customers to seek you out rather than having to persuade them. And it really requires a lot of analysis before you make those moves, because too many MDs are optimistic and they chase too many ideas on too many fronts without enough strategy behind it. But I think there is a big opportunity for those, A, because the civil loans are there, B, actually, you've got that right, again, private equity, there's huge sums of money looking to invest in private companies, typically £500,000 plus profits, that where they've got ambitious plans. Perhaps they don't want to take the risk themselves wholly. So you do a little private equity, de-risk a bit, maybe take some money off the table, then go for growth on those acquisitions. And that can be a very, very exciting sort of scale-up story. But you've got to be really clear where you're going to go and how you're going to focus and how you're going to create that return on investment. So a few other sort of points for me, Alistair. I mean, yeah, difficult one. What are the sort of typical fees on arranging finance these days? And I suppose there's one item we haven't touched on, we ought to talk about, is what's happening on commercial mortgages. So that two questions.
Okay, so in terms of fees, if we're talking about ABL, can be anything from sort of 1.5% to 2% of the of the facility.
Asset-based lending, yeah, ABL.
This is asset-based lending, yes, sorry. Yeah. So talking about assets, talking about invoices and stock and to an extent property in the side, sort of pull that together for the sake of answering this question. So typically sort of 1% to 2% fees for the safer end of the market, where the you know, the loan to value, if we're going to use that term to cover the to cover the whole ABL space, is fairly low, in the sort of 60s to 70%. And as you push up towards the 80% and the 90%, as you're trying to squeeze every last bit out, then fees will increase to reflect the fact that you're cutting your headroom, and they can go up to 4%, 5%, 6%. 4%, 5%, 6% of the facility. So again, you know, as with overall appetite, the riskier businesses will come with a higher initial fee to provide, you know, part of the return that the funder is looking to make on their on their lend. In terms of commercial property, again, you've got the sort of various tiers. You've got the high street banks who are, you know, looking at margins of sort of 2.5 to 3.5% over base at the moment. The second tier, they're probably looking at sort of 3.5 to 5, and then you've got other funders who will look at sort of 5% plus in terms of over base percentage margins over base, but they will be for the more risky lens, that, you know, you're starting to move into investments, speculative, where there's not a clear tenant or clear repayment in place. So you've got that range from the sort of 2.5% up to the, you know, the 7, 8, 9%.
And on property, yeah, commercial property, we, I know you also do, you know, buy to let in companies and stuff, but we're part of that. It's a different sector. But commercial property lending, really the advice is, if the business is premises dependent from a fixtures point of view, and having it in the company is not necessarily the end of the world these days for you. There was some advice in the old days, which is if you were buying property, try and put it in your pension, keep it separate. I think that can apply, particularly if it's not a premises dependent business, i.e. it's fairly easy to relocate. But increasingly, if you're looking to grow the company, maybe sell it, one of the concerns is that buyers of companies don't necessarily like having freeholds, because it doesn't create a good yield. That's changed a bit because there's so much money in the marketplace. We call it superabundant capital. Investors are actually far more relaxed. So whether you have it in a company or pension, again, come and talk to us. It's a harder debate. But I presume you've got a panel of lenders that will also work with pension funds, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, as I say, everybody has a niche. We were talking to one small bank, and they won't touch commercial property. They're only interested in investment properties, you know, from, you know, so, you know, that's their niche, and they focus on that completely. Others will look at a commercial property and go, yes, you know, fine, we're happy with that, but we really need to get behind the business that's operating out of it, because that's our repayment vehicle in effect. So the diligence might be a little bit different on something like that, because there's, you know, they'll get into the company and its performance, rather than just look at the quality of the asset itself, because that's the you know, that's their route for being repaid, etc. So there are guys who will look at all different sorts of aspects, but yeah, there's not a, if there is a reticence that I've heard against companies having a commercial property, it's an old-fashioned one, as you were referring to. You know, I'm investing in a business, not in a property company. If I want to invest in a property company, then I'll go and invest in a property company separately. But I think that is relatively old-fashioned. I think actually having a nice chunky lump of property in the balance sheet does provide a bit of comfort.
I think that's probably right these days. So, okay, well, look, I mean, we could go on forever and get really specific, and you know, obviously it's a fairly complex subject. So I think, you know, the offer's there. If you've got any questions on what we've covered, please come and talk to me or reach out to Alistair, we'd be more than happy to share. We do have a guide on our website, financing acquisitions and finance, so, you know, pull that off, but we'd be more than happy to you know, discuss where you've got to and what specific challenge you're facing. But really, for us, Alistair, just to sort of finish off for the day, what do you see as the biggest challenge in our work? What's the biggest barrier to what we do today?
Well, from my point of view, from a debt point of view, it's quite funny at the moment. It's the demand is lagging supply. The supply is out there. There are people coming into the market the whole time with a niche. They've seen a space. you know, the banks are pulling out of an area, and or they see that they've got a little bit of experience in a particular niche. So the demand is out there. I think the challenge is educating the market as to what's available. I think too often people go to the high street bank and they get a computer says no, and they think that's the end of their options. It absolutely isn't. It's no more than half the market. And there are specialists who will flex the risk profile to accommodate an awful lot more than people would sometimes know. But it's knowing where to look. And I think that's where we can come into it. We know where to look. We do spend a lot of time researching the market, speaking to the providers, and that knowledge, you know, we're more than keen to impart to the SME community.
But I would add to that, I think that's right, but I think there is a naivety about the level of information that's required to do this, and I think I think, you know, for me, one of the challenges is people are too casual about preparing and presenting, so that they are, you know, either finance or investor ready anytime in real time. So they, you know, there's an opportunity there for people to get slightly more organized on the money side, if you like. Because actually, as you put it, the rich are getting richer. Money helps grow companies, and you can't ignore that capital is relevant. So getting organized to access that, so you've got the right metrics, I think is a challenge for us to help people do, because they don't understand the importance of investing in it.
Yeah, no, I agree entirely. You know, as I said, you know, wherever you are in the funding spectrum, they will do their due diligence. It is a debt product. The margins might seem large, but they're taking on more risk. Overall, it doesn't take, you know, wherever you are in the market, it doesn't take many deals to go wrong for an awful lot of successful deals to get caught up in it. So the diligence and is important, and you're absolutely right. Get that preparation right. Otherwise, you're pushing water uphill to get back ahead of the game and get the banks on side if they've not got what they need to start with. So yeah, speak to you about it.
I'll leave you with the uphill stakes at the end there. That's a good line, Alistair. Really appreciate your time today. Excellent cheering about with you on some of the options, etc. Let's hope we can help some people, and we'll catch up soon, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.